You can't see it, you can't hear it, smell it, or taste it, and most of us can't feel it. But it's all around us, like an invisible spider web, growing stronger every day. It's the radiation from all of the wireless devices that are filling our lives. Smartphones, routers, laptops, tablets, baby monitors, 5G antennas, and so on. And at the same time as this explosion of technology is taking place, the scientific community is proving that radio frequency radiation, or wireless radiation, is having a biological impact on all living things, including humans.
So there's a giant tug of war going on, with the industry on one side trying to keep the lid on things, and scientists on the other side not really wanting to become advocates, but frustrated that people don't know what they know about the potential harm of wireless radiation. Dr. Joel Moskowitz is the director of the Center for Family and Community Health at the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley. Dr. Moskowitz has conducted research on disease prevention programs and policies for more than 40 years, most recently focusing on adverse health effects of cell phones and wireless radiation. Patty and I spoke with our friend Joel Moskowitz earlier this week. We asked him first to give an overview of what constitutes wireless radiation. Here's our conversation with Dr. Joel Moskowitz.
Wireless radiation is a form of radio frequency radiation, which can be emitted by all kinds of wireless devices, including cell phones and cell towers, Wi-Fi routers, a variety of wireless devices, and even many smart appliances. And although this is considered non-ionizing, which means it can't directly knock electrons out of their orbits, it does create significant harm to biological tissues through indirect mechanisms. So this is very different than radioactivity, which is considered ionizing, such as X-rays or gamma rays. But nonetheless, it still can be harmful to us and to other species, even at very low intensities.
Right, but for years, people thought that because it wasn't ionizing radiation, that it couldn't do any harm. Isn't that correct?
That was a misbelief, propagated in large part by the military originally and later by the telecom industry and other industries. It's a false notion to believe that exposure to radio frequency radiation or wireless radiation can't be harmful. We have hundreds of, if not thousands of studies showing biological harm, as well as some human studies showing evidence of increased cancer risk and other forms of tumors, headaches, a whole variety of problems can be created by exposure, both acute and chronic exposure to wireless radiation.
Joel, how long have we known that wireless radiation can really cause biological damage?
Well, since the 1930s, people were observed with physiological symptoms who were working with radio and electricity. And in the 1940s, with military radar, people were developing serious health problems from exposure to radar. But research on the biological impacts, although it's been going on for many decades, significant studies first started appearing in the 50s and 60s, particularly in the Soviet Union, where researchers repeatedly found changes in animal behavior and effects on the nerves' electrical properties when exposed to wireless radiation.
So we've had some major agencies, health agencies, including the World Health Organization, that initially said that they would categorize it as a 2B carcinogen. But it seems like there's been some misinformation lately that the World Health Organization now is saying that there is no harm from exposure at all. Can you just set that straight for us?
The World Health Organization has not proclaimed no harm. As far as I know, they've kind of dismissed the harm for many years, and they've basically been co-opted by the industry. The WHO EMF project was initially funded by industry with money funneled through a hospital in Adelaide Hospital in Australia. And the industry has basically captured that project. And the people within that project formed a group called the ICNIRP, the International Commission on Ionizing Radiation Protection, to create industry-friendly guidelines, which the WHO has promoted. So the WHO, unfortunately, in this case, has played a nefarious role in basically promoting guidelines that do not protect the health and safety of humans or any other species.
So this is, from what I understand, kind of like a self-appointed group of scientists who are friendly with the industry, and they're the ones that are passing judgment on whether the exposure limits are safe or not?
This has been of great concern to a newly formed group called the ICBE-EMF, or International Commission for the Biological Effects of Electromagnetic Fields, a group of scientists, including myself, that was commissioned as a result of an appeal that came out originally in 2015 that's now been signed by over 250 EMF scientists who published over 2,000 peer-reviewed publications on electromagnetic fields in biology or health.
And that appeal was to the United Nations?
That appeal was to the UN, the WHO, to all world governments. We've never gotten an official response from any governmental agency. That it's basically been ignored.
Wow.
But the appeal lives on. There's a website for the EMF scientist appeal. If you search on Google, International EMF Scientist Appeal, you can read the text. It has a pretty profound statement, which I can probably find right here. The 250 scientists have signed on an appeal, and it's not easy, by the way, to get scientists to sign, agree to an appeal, by the way.
Yeah, we know.
I know.
So the statement basically says, numerous recent scientific publications have shown that electromagnetic fields affect living organisms at levels well below most international and national guidelines. Effects include increased cancer risk, cellular stress, increase in harmful free radicals, genetic damages, structural and functional changes of the reproductive system, learning and memory deficits, neurological disorders, and negative impacts on general well-being in humans. Damage goes well beyond the human race, as there is growing evidence of harmful effects to both plants and animal life.
Wow.
And
okay.
This group endorsed and commissioned the ICBE-ENF, whose purpose is to make recommendations based on the best peer-reviewed science. Our group formed in 2021, and we're dedicated to ensuring the protection of all species from the harmful effects of non-ionizing radiation.
Wow. So you're talking about ICNIRP playing a role in what the World Health Organization, you know, is saying to the world about this type of radiation. But we'd had a landmark study from the National Toxicology Program, which is part of NIH, National Institutes of Health. That was a really important study. And can you just talk a little bit about what that study showed? Because it actually showed that there was damage from exposure.
Yeah, the National Toxicology Program cell phone radiation study ended up costing $30 million of federal money, taxpayer money. It was a large animal study, and it found that 2 years of cell phone radiation exposure to rodents, rats and mice, yielded clear evidence in male rats of increased cancer of the heart and, quote-unquote, some evidence of increased brain and adrenal gland tumors. The study also importantly found significant DNA damage in the brains of mice and rats of both sexes from even shorter-term exposure, and increased degeneration in the hearts of male and female rats, and decreased birth weight in the offspring of the female rats that were exposed prenatally. This randomized controlled trial or experiment proved that cell phone radiation can cause cancer without significantly heating tissue. Mm-hmm. This is important because the FCC's guidelines and the ICNIRP guidelines are only based upon a heating, short-term heating of tissue. What the consequence of this should mean is that the FDA should conduct a formal risk assessment and direct the FCC to strengthen the exposure limits, which were designed us only to protect us from these heating effects. Unfortunately, the FDA has basically dismissed its responsibility, has never taken its responsibility seriously to advise the FCC about the health risks of this form of radiation.
Also designed to protect the industry. You know, the standards that are in place protect the industry from any liability because the government says everything below that is safe. So, you know, when that NTP study came out, Joel, the official government position was, oh, this doesn't apply to humans.
Right.
Pay no attention to this. Pay no attention to this. This has nothing to do with people, which is so stupid on its face, because if you're going to spend $30 million on a study, you're not trying to decide whether mice and rats should use cell phones, right? That's not the purpose of the study. The whole purpose of the study was to determine whether or not there was biological damage occurring below a certain temperature, right? That it wasn't
right,
just
1 degree
heat.
Centigrade.
Yeah.
It's considered the heating threshold.
And also, this is, you know, they use the same rodent
pollutants that are used in all the studies that they do on, you know, on pesticides and all kinds of other things. And then they apply the results of those studies to humans. That's the whole point.
I think this just tells us that the telecom industry and the military are much stronger than pesticide industry and the food industry. Telecom industry alone spends over $100 million a year just lobbying at the federal level, plus they are active at the local and state level as well, ensuring that their interests are protected.
I'm interested in what the World Health Organization said, if anything, about the NTP study. I mean, it was a really well-designed study. I mean, just, you know, they dotted every I and crossed every T, and then they had that panel of reviewers, you know, afterwards that were independent and just said, you know, the results are clear.
Yeah, it went through 3 days of peer review from some of the world's leading experts before they published two massive technical reports the NTP did.
Right.
I don't know whether the WHO has taken an official position on the study. Their partner, ICNIRP, though, I-C-N-I-R-P,
right,
has basically dismissed the study along with the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, IEEE.
On what grounds?
Because they're dismissing it, claiming that the exposures were full-body exposures. It's unlike how people get exposed to this high level of radiation. The interesting thing is they've ignored essentially a replication study done by the Ramazzini Institute in Italy.
At the same time.
Yeah, which basically found the same kinds of cancer risk in male rats as the NTP study, using a much, much lower intensity exposure of radio frequency radiation, cell phone radiation.
Coming off antennas, right?
That's right. So it's much better simulation of cell tower exposure in that study.
Right.
So it seems like we got two things going on. First, we have this giant international powerful industry that's making billions of dollars, but using a technology that we know can be harmful. And we've got solid evidence of biological harm, but the disease endpoints associated with exposure to RF radiation have this long latency period. And, you know, those cancers could be caused by, you know, any number of other things. So it's an easy way for the industry to kind of skate away from any responsibility. But they know it. They know it. They know the science. They know the studies.
You know, but just as an example, I mean, there is an understanding in the medical community by, I'm sure, more than this one doctor at Sloan Kettering, but we knew someone who had a parotid gland tumor, and he eventually died within a year because it spread everywhere. But when he went to Sloan Kettering, which was the second hospital he was in for a second opinion, the surgeon said to him immediately, he said, you know, this is a cell phone tumor.
Yeah, parotid gland, by the way, is also salivary glands.
Right. It's a salivary gland that sits right below the ear.
Yeah, regarding another area that requires more concern is the thyroid gland. And there are two papers from a Yale Medical School study.
Mm-hmm.
First found a slightly elevated thyroid cancer risk among the long-term cell phone users. Then they did a follow-up study looking at genetic profiles of the individuals in the study, and they found that genetic susceptibility increases that association significantly. So it appears that wireless radiation may affect some people more than others, depending on their genetic makeup. So this is a very complicated area of study because there's a lot of factors that come into play.
I wanted to ask you about this because genetic susceptibility is something that is really hard to figure out. I mean, I've always wondered why some people are affected so deeply and seriously by exposure to RF radiation, those people who have a particular sensitivity to it. But it's not everybody. And so those people who are very sensitive are often dismissed as, you know, being crazy because other people don't feel it. And I'm wondering if you have an opinion on why that is that some people are so sensitive and others are not.
We have different genes. I mean, not everyone who smokes 3 packs a day of cigarettes gets lung cancer.
That's right.
There's genetic susceptibilities to various injuries or insults on our bodies. What we haven't talked about is a number of people increasingly are being affected from acute exposures to these forms of wireless radiation or even power line frequencies. It's estimated that 3 to 5% of the population suffer from a syndrome called electromagnetic hypersensitivity, or EHS.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an environmental intolerance, which could result in headaches, memory impairment, fatigue, insomnia, ringing of the ears or tinnitus, heart palpitations, a variety of symptoms. And this condition is controversial because it's very difficult to diagnose and physicians aren't trained in how to diagnose such things. But according to Physicians Weekly, it's called a clinical syndrome characterized by the presence of a wide spectrum of nonspecific multiple organ symptoms. And many patients appear to have impaired detoxification systems that become overloaded by excessive oxidative stress. In talking to clinicians who treat patients who have EHS, they say many of them originally had multiple chemical sensitivity, or vice versa, their patients with EHS develop multiple chemical sensitivity. So it becomes a generalized response to a variety of environmental agents, including chemical agents as well as electromagnetic agents that causes this syndrome. And increasingly, I think we're hearing more and more people develop this as we become exposed in our daily lives to more and more forms of wireless radiation. This is very unfortunate because it's really hard to get it diagnosed or treated currently.
We certainly are hearing more and more people who are developing sensitivity.
And we know people who have gone to Green Bank, West Virginia.
The canaries in the coal mine.
Yeah.
Because we're all electrically sensitive. It's just a matter of some of us are more sensitive than others.
Yeah.
And so this is stressing all of our bodies, not just those who experience these symptoms affected by this syndrome.
So, Joel, let me ask you this question. Given what you know, are you hopeful for the future? Are you optimistic about whether science is going to eventually win this argument?
I think science ultimately will win, but we may all be dead before it happens. It's a very long process. I mean, we're still fighting the tobacco war.
Yeah, we are.
In more than half a century now.
Yeah.
And it's morphed into an electronic cigarette war. And so nicotine addiction is still a major problem, and the consequences of that addiction is still a major problem. I spent most of my career dealing with the tobacco war.
Okay, so that didn't turn out so great, not so far. But, you know, we're working on a couple of different projects. One is the TechSafe Schools project. And, you know, it's really hard to get parents to get behind this because they are also addicted to their wireless technology, and it is an incredibly addictive obsession. People can't put it down. They have to check it every couple of minutes, if not more often than that. It's a really tough one. I mean, it's a really tough one to try to get anybody to think about the potential harm, the potential risk, even when it involves their children or their grandchildren, because they themselves are addicted and they, you know, they're just in denial.
Well, there was a period with regard to cigarettes back in the 50s and early 60s when half the population was addicted to that substance, and it was very difficult to talk to them about giving up cigarettes. There was also a period of time where people were resistant to seatbelts in cars, and the industry fought it tooth and nail, putting seatbelts and then airbags. And now it's become a marketing ploy to have safer vehicles. So looking at this from an optimistic lens, perhaps we'll get to a point where the industry will start marketing safer technology and the public will want to respond favorably to safer products. The ICBEMF has been promoting ALARA, ALARA, which means keep it as low as reasonably achievable. And that's, I think, a good guideline for all of us, is that we should minimize our exposure to these forms of radiation, be they Wi-Fi or cellular or Bluetooth, and reduce the risk of harm by adopting a variety of behaviors to minimize these exposures. For example, using a landline whenever possible, or secondly, remembering that distance is your friend, keeping your devices 10 inches from your body as compared to a tenth of an inch actually results in a 10,000-fold reduction in the exposure. It's the inverse square law. So keep your phone away from your head and body. Store it in a purse or backpack and text or use a wired headset or speakerphone for your calls if you're going to use a cell phone. Thirdly, cell phones are programmed to increase the exposure, the radiation, when the reception's poor. So you should only use your phone when the signal strength is strong and avoid using it in an elevator or a vehicle because metal structures can interfere with the signal. And finally, another simple thing you can do is turn off all your wireless devices at bedtime, mm-hmm. including your Wi-Fi router. But better yet, use wired connections, not Wi-Fi, because cable, Ethernet, or optical fiber are much faster, they're more secure and safer than 4G or 5G cellular. So there's a variety of things that individuals can do to reduce their risk. But we're also promoting industry doesn't have to wait on government to take action, because the governmental agencies have been co-opted by the industry and are protecting them. But some of the industry could get it, might be able to get an advantage by marketing safer technology.
Dr. Joel Moskowitz, director of the Center for Family and Community Health at the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley. You can learn more about his work and find links to everything we talked about on the show today on our program website, greenstreetnews.org. We're going to take a short break now, but don't go away. Patty and I will be right back.
And this is Green Street on WBAI, the Environmental Health Show. Patty and Doug Wood, thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Happy to have you with us on this special edition of Green Street. We're asking for your financial support for the station.